Namaskar. Hello and welcome to P Guru's channel. I'm your host, Sri Iyer. Apologies for the slight delayed start. Let's welcome Professor M.D. Nalapat, and we have some breaking information as far as China is concerned. Professor Nalapat, Namaskar and welcome to P Guru's channel. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, Sri. Thank you very much for having me in your show.
Professor Nalapat, first off, how's your new book doing, sir?
I don't want to talk about it very much, but you know, you mean the book that I brought out in September?
Yes, 2023,
last Cold War 2.0. It's doing very well. It's available except in China, North Korea, Pakistan, and a few other, you know, friendly places like that. It's available around the world, including the United States. So I would suggest that you talk about it in the sense that you get it. We already discussed it. Because I do believe that many, many years ago, I had raised this issue that we are into a new Cold War. And I remember there was a lot of resistance to that idea. People just refused to believe that this was another Cold War. And unfortunately, a lot of people are caught up in a time warp. And they're back in the old Cold War with Russia. When the new Cold War with China began, in my opinion, the catalyst was 1997 handover of Hong Kong. The way that was done, frankly, the British basically conceded every single demand made by the Chinese side. And all they got was a piece of paper in return, which frankly had as much credibility as a scrap of paper that Chamberlain brought with him after his Munich meeting with Hitler. And as you know, over the years from 1997, the autonomy of Hong Kong has been whittled down. For about 10, 15 years before 1997, every year the autonomy would go up. But don't forget, it was a colony of the British. And there has never been democracy in Hong Kong in the real sense of the term. But the fact is that about 12 to 15 years before 1997, every year there were efforts at democratizing the colonial structure in Hong Kong. And Chris Patten, the last governor, worked very hard at that. And at the close of it by 1997, Hong Kong was, I would say, a moderately democratic place to be in. Moderately democratic. Not fully, but moderately. Well, from that time onwards, there's been a steady erosion of the democracy the fabric of democracy in Hong Kong. And in about 2012, when Xi Jinping took over, he made it absolutely clear that there's going to be a continuous erosion and a rapid erosion. Now, what happened? The Hong Kong people were surprised by that. They frankly reacted to that. And that reaction was starting to build up around 2016 or so. And it was obvious to people who were following it on the ground. By 2019, it was a full-fledged public manifestation of anger against the way that Xi Jinping was trying to de-democratize Hong Kong. And you know what happened after that? The Chinese converted Hong Kong into another Shanghai or Beijing, completely under CCP control. That scrap of paper that was signed by the British, which lasted until 2047, was just torn up in effect by Xi Jinping. And that is why I said it was worth the exact the same value as the piece of paper that Chamberlain brought from Munich when he came back from that conference with Hitler, and in which Hitler said, well, I'm not going to make any more demands on Europe.
Except for, you know, he did break it again. Professor Nalapat, this is a very nice beginning to what we are seeing playing out today in mainland China. Viewers, I just want to, you know, bring the perspective in. That's why Professor Nalapat started with Hong Kong. There is an article that he wrote in Sunday Guardian that appeared yesterday, Sunday. And it talks about the grand plan that CCP has for after they annex Taiwan. They've already planned it out. It's all in their mind. Everything is planned out. This is what they're going to do. They've even identified the people that they want to take care of. That to that level, this planning has been done. So I urge you all to read that article. Professor Nalappa will be talking about that today. Why this question is going to be asked, I'm going to come to that in just one moment, because Blinken, I think he's still there or he's about to return back to the United States. This is the second time he has come to China in the last few months, and he's returning empty-handed. What really happened there? I know what happened from the American perspective. MD Nalappaji is in the thick of things. He's a China expert. Sir, what happened? This time, I'll just set the stage for our viewers, because there are going to be a couple of follow-up interviews about this in the next couple of days, viewers. So just stay tuned for that also. Sir, I'll just set you. Protocol-wise, both Janet Yellen, who came just a few days ago, and Blinken, they were snubbed. That's the only way I can put it. They didn't come into Beijing. One person came into Guangzhou and the other person came into Shanghai. And the person of equal rank did not receive them. And so there was some sort of a snub on part of China. And the United States has been asking China not to export anything to Russia. And China has said it will not, except it went and broke its promise. With this is the setting. Talk to us what happened, you think, when Janet Yellen came and then afterwards Blinken came.
Well, Sri, frankly, I hope that Antony Blinken and Janet Yellen did not have any high expectation from China. But the fact that they came there basically gave a lot of face to Xi Jinping, because he's under pressure in the CCP for having completely damaged relations with the West. And he wanted to show that's not true. You have Olaf Scholz coming and kissing my ring. You have now Yellen and Blinken coming. And I and Biden was there, with me in California, where you are actually. So frankly, this gave a lot of face to Xi Jinping, but they didn't get anything back for simple reason that thank you for referring to my front page piece in the Sunday Guardian of Sunday, the 28th. But I'd like to say that the fact is that Xi Jinping has, from the start of his rule in 2012, not only acknowledged the reality of Cold War 2.0, and by the way, this book is available, as I told you, all across the world, except in China, Pakistan, and a few other countries like that. But the fact is that they are working to a plan. The question is the United States working to a plan? Judging by the public appearances and public utterances, I don't think so. I think the United States has got itself sucked into a strategic quagmire. And that strategic quagmire is very helpful to the Chinese. It is keeping them enmeshed in the old Cold War with Russia and basically much less attention to the new developing Cold War with China. And again, may I say, point out that Ukraine, I don't believe Ukraine is of any great strategic significance to any country except Russia, because Ukraine and Belarus are the two places from where you can invade Russia. The United States lived very comfortably and in fact did extremely well. It won the Cold War, even though Ukraine was part of the USSR. Now it is no longer part of the USSR. I think France, Britain, Germany, none of these countries that are now claiming that Ukraine is essential for security had any problem when Ukraine was part of the USSR, or when, frankly, Ukraine was friendly to the USSR. But they engineered a regime change operation through the streets. And the point is, Xi Jinping is delighted. He would like to, I predicted way back in 2022. You can check my appearances now, fortunately, because of the internet. You can check back. I made my Cold War references at a 2.0 references at a time when internet was not very active. But the references about Xi Jinping wanting to prolong the Ukraine conflict for as long as possible. In fact, I mentioned, for as long as it takes to ensure that he has some outstanding military success to show during his term in office. Now, look at Gaza. You know, look at what's happening in Gaza. I mean, this conflict is being kept going not only by Israel, but by the superpower that's backing Hamas from the very beginning. And Hamas, all said and done, I'm surprised that too many channels have not talked about the textbooks that Hamas has prescribed for Gazan school children. Those textbooks basically portray the Jewish community as some kind of evil, you know, outer space people from outer space, essentially a community that needs to be removed, and Christians as being facilitators of this Jewish state, what they call, you know, a menace and parasites, etc., etc. And these are all there in plain view of the textbooks. And this is an old history, Sri. The United States never reads any textbook except maybe their own textbooks and in English. I don't think they have read textbooks in Central Asia. You remember a long time back, after I pointed out that in the Central Asian republics, the school curriculum was being flooded by Wahhabi textbooks and that terrorism would follow. The same kind of textbooks that you see in Pakistan, you see, and unfortunately at one point in time in Saudi Arabia, but unfortunately under Mohammed bin Salman is not there, you saw it in Central Asia. It's a matter of great luck that Central Asia has not fallen under the kind of extremist rule, as for example, Egypt briefly had under Mohammed Morsi or the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, the Wahhabis have nothing to do with Islam. Islam is a glorious religion. It's a wonderful religion. They have nothing to do with Islam. And both Khomeinism and Wahhabism are completely different from the Shia and the Sunni. But they masquerade as being the authentic Shia and the authentic Sunni. So all I'd like to say, very frankly, Hamas is being kept going by China. And this is something I said in the very first few days of this conflict. Netanyahu doesn't know what's coming at him. It's been kept going. And I'm very certain that the satellite data, the tracking data, information on the about the other side was provided by a very sophisticated superpower. I'm not going to name that superpower. There are only two in the world. It can't be the United States. So now you have that. Then you have other conflicts that are flaring up here and there. And Gaza, because it involves basically a very staunch friend of the United States, a staunch regional ally, Israel. And as I said, and I think I don't know if I said it on your channel, I said it on several occasions, that this attack was facilitated by a superpower. The kind of sophistication that was launched, it was military efficiency. Hamas doesn't have that kind of capability, the military wing. It was very sophisticated. It was not Iran. Everybody talks about Iran. Iran definitely is getting help from China, but it is mostly helping the Shia factions. Hamas is not a Shia faction. It claims to be a Sunni faction. And there's a big difference between Shia and Sunni where the Middle East is concerned. So it is not really Iran that is front and center, but which occupied the attention of U.S. policymakers. The fact is, judging by their words and by their actions, public actions, it doesn't seem that they really have a knowledge that there is a new Cold War and they're in a deadly existential battle with China. Something that the Chinese side has understood long back and which is now playing out in full view. Look at TikTok. The courts stopped it once. They may stop it a second time around. As it is, it's not really speeding up. The fact is that TikTok in the United States is very different from its counterpart Douyin in China. It basically feeds antisocial behavior. It promotes risk. Most of all, it promotes a contempt for democracy, a contempt for politicians who are in power, a contempt for all politicians, democratic politicians in general. It does that very clearly. And it doesn't just do it through the 6% or so of its content that is editorial content. You look at that content, it's very helpful to CCP. Even their images are basically about what a mess in democracies. You've got people using the streets of cities in New York, and I mean New York and San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, as public bathrooms, the pavements. You've got all kinds of horrible photographs there that give an impression that the United States has now entered a dystopian phase of irretrievable decline. And that is the impression that TikTok wants to convey. And this, frankly, is why I'm glad that the Republicans took the initiative and that enough Democrats supported them, that there is this proposal for a ban. And I hope that it becomes effective. And I hope the courts don't intervene, because there is a direct correlation between what you're seeing in several democratic societies, a kind of mini implosions, mini explosions, you know, growth of the fringe, shrinking of the moderate middle, and TikTok and other Chinese platforms and other Chinese applications and other Chinese misinformation and disinformation methods. Janet Yellen came back saying the Chinese will do this and will do that. Well, that's the same. Chamberlain came back saying that Hitler will do this and do that. Janet Yellen didn't seem to realize that she was holding some worthless promises. I don't know if, maybe she does, and she's not letting on in public. But Blinken publicly at least doesn't seem to acknowledge that these promises are worthless, that they're never meant to be kept. The fact is, the Chinese system is an existential battle with what you would call the US system, but what I would call the democratic system. India is a democracy. We are not the US, but we are a democracy in our own way. And I think democracies especially have the right to be democracies in their own way and not be lectured to that it either our way or the highway. And, you know, you become roadkill on the highway if you don't go our way. So that has been ongoing. It was by about 21, 22, 23, 2003, it became obvious that planning had begun. Jiang Zemin, frankly, for some time was not. That is why a very careful effort was made under the last 1 or 2 years of Jiang Zemin, then Hu Jintao, to basically make sure that reliance on the West for a lot of items was reduced and reduced and reduced. And now Xi Jinping has made it clear that anybody who buys Western goods, even especially luxury goods, I never been able to understand how something that looks like a laundry bag you can buy in Beijing for $10,000 or $20,000. I can never understand it. Not only in Beijing, but in different parts of the world. And people proudly go around with their laundry bags that cost $20,000, but because it's got some kind of a brand name in it, which is worthless. So the fact is, the Chinese leadership has got it. I'm not sure that the US leadership has. And this is on both sides of the aisle. I think the US is a bit overconfident about victory. I see no reason to be so overconfident, because these guys are working to a plan. They're ruthless. The United States doesn't seem to have a coherent plan and doesn't even seem to acknowledge that we are in Cold War 2.0. And they're still reacting as though it's Cold War 1.2. Now, you have, for example, a few people in the Republican Party who have called it out. Out of that 60, that $90 billion package or something, $61 billion for Ukraine. It's not the important theater. Taiwan gets about $13-14 billion. Taiwan is the key theater. It should be getting the $60 billion. It's getting, compared to Ukraine, peanuts. And Israel is also getting much lower than Ukraine. Israel is important. There's no question about it. Saudi Arabia is important. Egypt is important. All these countries are important. And I wish they had also been included. But the reality is that the Chinese side knows it's in a Cold War. Xi Jinping is working to a plan. You mentioned my Taiwan article. We'll discuss that subsequently. But I'm not sure that much of the rest of the world realizes that we are in a new Cold War and are basically ensuring that this Cold War is also won by the democracies. because I don't see that same fighting spirit, that same determination, that same careful planning, that coordination, that activity in the rival country that was characterized by during Cold War 1.0. I don't see it a tenth of that, maybe even less of that, where China is concerned. Whereas China is 20 times the threat that the Soviet Union ever was to the United States, to Western civilization, and to democracy. The People's Republic of China, I mean, the CCP. I wouldn't say China. Chinese people are good. China is an ancient civilization. I'm talking about the leadership of the CCP.
Thank you so much, Professor Nalapat. Viewers, a couple of things I want to add here. You know, India is consumed with the heat and dust of the elections, but a lot of things are happening that India is not turning its attention to. In fact, not just India, even the United States. This is a set of three videos that we are putting out. This is video number two. Video number one, I'll come to you just 1 second, sir. Video number one aired today morning, my discussion with Kalabhai Venkat about why Soros and Sanders are sticking it to Israel. Both are Jews. So there is a reason there why we put it out, because it is right there in front of us, but somehow we are blind to it. And the third one that I will be putting out will be in a few hours' time, where my conversation with Elmer Yuen, and that will kind of round out what is going on here. Professor Nalapat, you wanted to make a point. I have a couple of questions, sir. Go ahead.
Look, I want to make a point, Sri, that the Americans, I mean, the Chinese have got them figured out through their apps and their stealing of data. They can figure out the psychological profiles of large segments of the American public. And they know how to basically what buttons to press to make the public angry, unhappy, misfits. They know all that. And therefore, the most liberal donations, essentially originating from China, come to democracies like the United States during election time. Because they know during election time, politicians need money. And they don't look too carefully at where they're getting it from. And anyway, tracking that money to CCP is becoming more and more difficult, because they are getting more and more expert in hiding the origin of that money. But a huge bump in funding takes place during election time. And this is the time when you have the maximum funding and the maximum election interference in terms of the bots, misinformation, disinformation, so that politicians who don't like get, get pushed aside, and politicians who believe in the old Cold War, and whom they're very comfortable with, and who basically ignore that they're in an existential conflict with China, they get elected. So this is a danger for democracies everywhere. Chinese money, Wahhabi money is everywhere. It's awash in through multiple channels. And that is one reason why, unfortunately, so many politicians, they talk about China. In the case of the United States, for example, a lot more needs to be done to counter China. It's not been done so far. There's a lot of talk, but no action. And Blinken said, I discussed that. But he's secretaries of state have discussed that from the 1980s onwards with the Chinese side. Blinken is, how many years ago is that? More than 40, 45 years. Nearly 45 years. What's the point? Janet Yellen said, discussed the Chinese are not going to stop. They're going to try and de-dollarize the world. You remember you and I discussed that. I've written about it many, many years ago. And they're working on that. Whatever Janet Yellen says or doesn't say, they're working on that. They're working on flooding the United States with imports. And that is happening as we speak. They're working on stealing tech. They're working on blackmailing American companies into ensuring that they remain in China, and particularly don't go to India. So they're working on all that. So frankly, I don't know, Sri. It really surprises me to see this level of incomprehension about the fact that the United States, naming your country, is in an existential battle 20 times more risky for the United States than the battle with the Soviet Union ever was since the mid-1950s.
Thank you, Professor Nalapat. A couple of things I want to say. One, what Professor Nalapath alluded to keeping companies within China, I have put two shots. I know everybody has a paucity of time, so I have put two shots. The real reason Elon Musk is in China, part one was at 6 a.m. today, part two was at 4 p.m. today. When you find time, it's just 1 minute, 1 minute. Take a look at that because it tells you what is really happening there. And like Professor Nalapath said, the United States got sucked into this without fully understanding what is happening. My book, Who Painted My State Purple, came out 3 years ago, Professor Nalapath, and I talked about how data siphoning has been done. And since then, 3 years now, and TikTok is still thriving, it still has 9 months, they think they can twist people's arms and somehow manage to still be there. And the important takeaway here is one of the co-authors of TikTok is my good friend, Congressman Radha Krishnamurthy. So we have put muscle behind it. So they wanted this TikTok thing to be connected with something that was sure to pass. And it did pass by bipartisan. Both the Republicans and Democrats have actually passed that funding. And along with that, this TikTok bill also, this is called pork bill, but that's okay. The point here is at least the first step has been taken in America that TikTok is going to be banned. But the data siphoning has been going on for a long time. Articles have been written, books have been written. But the thing is, we don't seem to understand it. One before we go, sir. One last thing. Viewers, please like this video. It deserves 10 times the traffic it is getting right now. Please like this video. Thank you, sir. Over to you.
Sri, TikTok will be working very hard. The CCP will be working very hard to ensure it's a friendly takeover. Not in public, but in effect. So that somebody who will allow, frankly, 90%, if not, let's say 70% minimum, 90% ideally, of current CCP infiltration to continue. So they'll be looking at some individual who, for sake of money, will basically be a useful idiot of the Chinese state. And that is what they'll be looking at now. So don't believe that transferring its ownership is going to be sufficient. You have to have a complete root and branch overhaul of the editorial content and the toxic content that it is putting out, in which the people in democracies are taught to hate democracy, hate their countries, have contempt for other people in their own country. That kind of toxicity has to be removed. My worry is TikTok will fall into quote-unquote friendly hands.
Well, again, this is still early days and we'll have to see how this thing plays out. Clearly, you have to appreciate Prime Minister Modi for showing the backbone to ban TikTok, PUBG, this thing, that thing. 130 software apps that were all originating from China, that were harvesting data of Indians. That was a big move, guys. That's the bold move. I mean, goddammit, Biden doesn't want to do it because he thinks that if he bans TikTok, he will lose the youth vote. That's the main reason. It's not that he's not happy about data being siphoned. He's only wanting to come back. That is what the reason is. He has said it himself, Professor Nalapath. Anyway, that's a topic for a different day. In conclusion, Professor Nalapath, do you think, in your personal opinion, because your article seems to suggest this, that today China might be planning on attacking Taiwan instead of India because they thought it will come after India because Xi Jinping personally doesn't want Modi to come back for a third term. Of course, the other side, India is malleable and ductile. Over to you, sir.
Well, I would say that the Indian soldier is a significant threat to Chinese. Indian demography is a significant threat to Chinese. We can mobilize large amounts of manpower on the battlefield. Taiwan has always been front and center of Xi's ambition, and he has made a vow that in my term, I will get Taiwan. And in my view, he will have to fulfill that vow the third term, or he won't get a fourth term. So Taiwan is definitely under threat. And through, you've got your sources, I've got my sources. And over the months, we have pieced together the jigsaw of what is planned for the Taiwanese side. Checked it, double-checked it, checked all the relevant information, who is giving it, whether they had the requisite input at the point in time when they were part of the system. And I'm quite... And what has been written in Sunday Guardian is exactly what is in store for Taiwan. Should it ever happen that it falls under PRC control? I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Taiwanese people are resolute. They've got excellent cyber capacity. They've got very good other capacities. And I think, you know, Taiwan is going to be what Britain was during the Second World War. It will stand out. Britain stood out, like Winston Churchill or not, and I don't like him. I mean, under him, Britain stood out. And like it or not, the Taiwanese leadership today is very, very strongly committed to the freedom and democracy of Taiwan. So I'm not pessimistic. But the fact is, it's very likely that by 2027, Xi Jinping will have to make an effort. And why should we 2027? But by that time, unrest in China will be huge. Already 27% of Chinese graduates have no jobs. Now you have 4 years, 6 years of education, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, no job. And every year, more people are coming in the market. So at the end of 4 years, you lose your hope. So when that builds up and builds up and builds up and starts boiling, you're going to get a problem. And inside the CCP, there's a lot of anger at the fact that Xi Jinping is basically only his people are getting any slice of the pie, the governance pie and the quote-unquote profits pie. And that is something which frankly, at different levels of CCP, the salaries are miserably low in China. The salaries of even those at the top are miserably low. So they used to get by other activity. Now, they're hardly doing an activity because they don't get any money, first of all, for that activity. And secondly, they run the risk of being executed or sent to prison if they're not completely regarded as 100% with Xi Jinping. And that can change day to day. So I think he's heading to a crisis, and his response to a crisis may be an external war. And I think Taiwan is definitely going to be the priority target. And what I've described is basically what he has in view for ensuring that the virus of democracy is snuffed out in Taiwan. The essential aim of the CCP is to snuff out that quote-unquote virus from across the world. I hope someday the United States is going to get that.
Thank you, Professor Nalapat. With your permission, sir, we have a few questions, if you don't mind. We have about two or three questions, so let's just run through them. Magnet Ranga wants to know, is US losing it? Blinken returns empty-handed is the topic of this hangout. Not too long ago, Biden failed in Saudi. Bharat could be stopped buying oil from Russia.
Sri, I don't believe Bharat is going to be stopped, and it's not going to be stopped buying oil from Russia. It's going to continue to have very good relations with Russia. And frankly, I think given the situation regarding the Ukraine war and given the multiplying evidence against PRC hostile activities, I think the United States also recognizes and countries in Europe also recognize that India being friendly to Russia, at least there's some major bridge that the Russians like and trust. And there is a relationship of liking and trusting between India and Russia. So I don't believe that, there was a lot of pressure in the initial 6-7 months of the Ukraine war. Today is not there at all. I'm not saying that it's welcome, but don't forget, there'll be no sanctions on India at all for buying Russian oil. And as I said, the basic reason is any military plan that conceives of an Indo-Pacific defense, let's say, for example, if Taiwan is attacked, has two prongs. One, India has got to be part of it. And two, you have to escalate the conflict way beyond Taiwan. You'd escalate it into the entire Indo-Pacific, escalate it into the Horn of Africa, escalate it into the Red Sea, the Malacca Straits, escalate it into what I wrote yesterday, should be called the ASEAN Sea. I don't know why it's called South China Sea. It's got nothing to do with China. It's got everything to do with ASEAN. And I think people should start, your show should start calling it's the ASEAN Sea. So that escalation dominance will fail without India. And I'll tell you why, Xi. Manpower. The fact is, the fortunately, the Chinese soldier also, but even more, the US soldier, the European soldier, they're not being trained really in actual combat. And they have, you know, in the sense that they were in Iraq and other places against enemies that are really very much smaller in capability than they are. And they have, and in regular combat, they have not really had a regular combat. The last time was, I mean, during the Second World War. So, as a consequence, they lack the cutting edge that regular combat gives the military. The Indian military has that in spades, the Army, Navy, and Air Force. So, I think, frankly, the United States and the rest of NATO, they understand the importance of India. First of all, they understand that Prime Minister Modi is not going to, you know, listen to any advice except what he believes is good for India. And it's good for India to buy Russian oil. I saw some website which has been created by people like Victoria Nuland, but calls itself Ukrainian, saying, stop all Russian oil purchases throughout the world. You're going to see oil prices go up by 2.5 times almost immediately. Forget about the longer term, immediately. So essentially, it is self-harm. It's suicidal what is happening. And if you do what the so-called Ukrainians, who are basically not Ukrainians at all, but this Cold War 1.0 Cold Warriors in the West, if they want you to do, which is try and make the largest country in the world a pariah country, it's not going to happen. And very importantly, Sri, you're talking about my book. I think a very important part of that book is going to be how the West will need to reconfigure itself, because it is in the process of losing the global South. The global South is watching. You're so interested in a European country, you're not bothered about Taiwan. You're not bothered about any other country. You're just talking about a European country. And the West is losing the global South. And the Chinese are moving into for the kill. Wherever you're seen in US manufacturing withdraws from the US, Chinese come in. Whenever information flow is slow on the US side, Chinese misinformation comes in. So very frankly, the US is losing the global South, largely as a consequence of the Ukraine war. And again, I'd like to say, please check it out. I pointed this out long back, that this is one of the big risks of the Ukraine war early in 2022 itself.
Thank you, sir. And next question, please. Uday Parmar wants to know, on a serious note, can USA take on China? To believe or not to believe is secondary. Even if US does not believe in China, what options does USA have?
Frankly, Sri, the soft underbelly of China is China. The soft underbelly of China is the Chinese people. And the Chinese people are very patient people. But if you know them, after a point, they basically will do whatever it takes. You had that revolution, I think, in 1919, that overthrew the rule of the emperors, hundreds of years. Then you had the KMT being overthrown by 1949 by the communists. So very frankly, I think the soft underbelly of China is China. And that is where, if the United States were to do 1/50th of what China is doing in the United States to basically misinform and make the United States a dystopian country, as I told you, using payments as bathrooms and things like that. Well, I would say that yes, the war can be won. But if you continue on this track, well, your own society will be in a position where it will not want to take on China, where it will say, forget about in any other country. They will just wait meekly while the Chinese system comes, commands the markets, commands the logistical chains, and basically overwhelms the United States and any trace of democracy. So frankly, Sri, the US can very definitely take on China together with India, together with the other democracies, together with most of the global South. If you look at many in the global South, the fact is that the elites may be bought by China. The people are not with China at all. In Nepal, a Chinese says, I'm Taiwanese, because if you're a Chinese, you're not liked. In Pakistan, Chinese are the targets. Pakistanis don't like the Chinese at all. Sri Lanka, same thing. Bangladesh, that's going to happen. So very frankly, the soft underbelly is China. But the soft underbelly in conventional warfare is Taiwan. South China Sea is lost de facto. So now it's got to be regained. It's got to be re-won. That's much more difficult than stopping losing it. And unfortunately, that continued for several presidents, even before Obama's time, especially during Obama's time, and thereafter, unfortunately, even during Trump and now Biden. But the fact is very, very simple. The soft underbelly of China is China. And that is where the United States needs to pay attention. But the second thing is the conventional, in my view, the conventional war is much more likely over Taiwan because they're trying to soften up Taiwan for a conventional war. They're trying to create an impression that if Chinese soldiers come, they're going to be very friendly. They're going to just be like one big family reunion. Everybody will be family, all love and, you know, love and cookies. But that's not the case. So that is the point. And therefore, I think the defense of Taiwan needs to be much more a priority than I'm seeing in the particular budget that was passed by the Republicans and the Democrats in the U.S. Senate. That budget, frankly, makes no geopolitical sense at all, given the realities of power, the power balance in the world.
Thank you, sir. Next question, please. This is the last question. Partha wants to know, how do you see MGJSW joint venture and Toyota talking about co-producing EVs with BYD? Is the economy forcing Xi for regional cooperation, or is he taking partners for possible liabilities?
Look, BYD is being sold in different countries in the world. It's a security risk. I think in 2-3 years' time, enough is going to happen that BYDs get banned in several countries. And if you have any kind of a co-production with them, I don't think the lifespan will be more than 2 or 3 years. And you can check this out 2 or 3 years later, because BYD is a Chinese Trojan. And the point is to build your own champions. And I'm glad that, for example, you know, you have Tesla looking at coming to India. You have Foxconn in China, where, you know, leaving China and increasingly coming to India. TSMC, in my view, needs to do the same thing, because in 2 or 3 years, TSMC, any production in China, apart from the fact that its intellectual input will be stolen, will not be saleable anywhere. So I think that trend is continuing. And I think by 2027, you're going to see a lot of these trend lines meet. So if you're going to have an EV, that EV is going to have a lifespan of 3 to 4 years before it starts getting serious security issues.
Thank you so much, Professor Nalapat. And what a discussion that was. Very, very revealing. Viewers, like I said, you have to not just watch this one video, but you have to watch them as a part of a three set. First one came in the morning. This is second one. The third one will come within 24 hours. Do watch that, because we easily get consumed by news these days, but the bigger picture is being fought elsewhere. Also, I'm hearing, and this is just for information's sake, cookies are doing the same thing that Hamas did to Israel. Imagine how prepared is the Indian government to face something similar to what Hamas did to Israel. Just keep that thing in your mind, viewers, because I'm getting a lot of data, including videos. So it's not just, somebody said something on internet. No, I'm getting video proof. Yes, sir, you wanted to say something and then we'll run it down.
Not all cookies, but cookies are crossed over from Myanmar and yes, were crossed over from territory that's effectively controlled by the PLA.
Yes.
I said in the beginning itself, when this Myanmar junta took power, that watch out, you're going to get an influx of people. Many of them are going to be agents of the PLA and the Chinese security services. And unfortunately, in the name of humanism and whatever, a lot of individuals were, came into India. And these are the people who are now creating trouble. So as an ethnic group in India, the Kukis are very peaceful. But unfortunately, on the other side, they've been indoctrinated. And they are now coming and, doing a lot of mischief. So frankly, this is what's happening. And I think it was with the best of intention. But I think we have to recognize that one third of the India-Myanmar border is actually a part of the India-China border.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much, Professor Nalapat. And we'll be following up on the other information about the Manipur, what's happening on the border. Just stay tuned, viewers. Please like, share, and subscribe to our channel. Don't forget to click on the bell button for notifications. Namaskar.
Jai Hind.